Hi, and welcome to Last Man Standing with a little hitch there. You're live here with me, Paul Stevenson, on this Sunday, the 5th of June, 2022. Before I forget, if you go to Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, and do donate to us. We need you to support us. We are, well, we're 90% listener supported. We do have some advertisers, but on networks like this, where we don't hold back when it comes to speaking the truth, it's not always easy getting advertisers. So we do rely on you, the listeners, to keep us on the air, because we talk about stuff that you're not going to be able to talk about anywhere else. So if you go to that homepage, Republic Broadcasting Network, republicbroadcasting.org, on the right-hand side, you will find where to donate. All right, so last month I did a roundtable. There was four or five of us, including one of my guests tonight was with us as well. And I thought it was really enjoyable when you get a few guys on. Ideas tend to bounce around and marinate, and I thought it was quite interesting and stimulating. So I've decided to do one of these every month. Originally, I'd plan to do this at a different time, but it didn't suit the guys in the US. But I've got an all UK and all England, I think, panel tonight. We have Wesley Russell, and I've done a show with Wesley before, and I met him at the Patriotic Alternative Conference last autumn, where he gave a fantastic speech. It was a very stimulating and thought-provoking speech, and he's a nice lad. And I also met Euro at that event as well when I was there, and he gave a speech at the following PA conference in the spring, if I'm correct. And he's also a great lad, and he's been on with us a couple of times, and he has some very stimulating thoughts and has a lot to contribute. So welcome, lads. It's great to have you, and I'm sure our US audience is looking forward to hearing from you. It's an all this side of the pond roundtable today.
Well, thanks for having me on, Paul, and it's going to be a great conversation, I'm sure.
I'm sure it is. And are you with me, Euro, as well?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks for having us on, both of us, and I'm sure it will be a brilliant chat on this Diamonds Jubilee roundtable.
Yes, indeed. Have you guys been celebrating any of that? How do you feel about that? I must admit, it just kind of, it's not because I'm from Ireland, I don't think. I just sort of never really participated or got too excited about these type of things. Where are you guys at? Do you celebrate it even in, just for the sake that at least it's some celebration of Britain in any way, or how do you feel about all that?
Well, my personal thoughts are I'm just kind of indifferent, really. It's nice seeing the bunting. It's nice seeing the Union flag. That's obviously nice. Gives you a bit of sense of patriotism, a bit of national unity, I guess. But it's hard to feel that these days, considering we're so divided in the West. But it is nice. In terms of actually appreciating the Queen, again, I don't really appreciate the Queen. I think the general consensus on the distant right is that Queen Elizabeth has been lackluster and not used any potential political power that she has to in the interests of the native peoples. And I was saying this just on my show the other day, that if she's happy for the native Brits to be replaced, then she should be happy with us wanting to replace her royal family, because she's giving nothing, providing nothing for the British people.
That's a very good point. And I think, you know, what does it even mean to be British anymore? You know, I mean, you do tend to associate it, obviously, with, you know, people from these lands. But I almost feel as if it's because as if British has been, you know, it's just this wide net now for so many people. You know, it doesn't matter what part of the world they're in, you know, they can just say they're British. I mean, it's actually a bit of a wrecking ball in many ways, I think. What do you think, Euro? Or would it matter? Would it matter even if they weren't British? I mean, people would just, they would come here anyway, regardless, but some people will sort of, you know, they will, you know, protest. I'm British, you know, I'm from one of the Commonwealth countries or whatever, you know.
Just as British as you, bro. As the saying goes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Just as British as you is, right.
I mean, so personally, I'm not really much of a monarchist. I have no particular feeling either way. If we look at it in terms of what the royal family has done for us, it's absolutely nothing. Whether it's through sheer incompetence, indifference, or, you know, whether there is somebody behind that curtain controlling them and preventing them from, you know, doing what they might otherwise want to do, they've done nothing to stop our dispossession and our course towards eventual extinction in this country. So I've got no love lost for them. But, you know, and it's a very civic nationalist thing, you know, like wave the flags, hooray the Queen, and people of all races supposedly can get involved in that. But if you look at it, it's almost unanimously a like white middle class thing that happens. But it is great to see the anti-whites get triggered by the bunting and flags everywhere, you know. And if you want to have some cake and scones and things like that, you know, and use it as a reason for a party, why not? You know, let's not be too sad sack about it.
Yeah, I suppose it gives people a couple of days off work and that type of thing, and people can have a beer. But generally, it is pretty cringe, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think what can be cringe, especially to people of our persuasion, is if, you know, people are showing a real commitment, a real love for Queen Elizabeth, the royal family. But again, there's no reciprocation, is there? What does the royal family do for the people? It would be one thing if the royal family actually had a political role, as in they actually made policy, they actually ruled. But unfortunately, Parliament has completely supplanted the royals as an institution. So it's literally just completely aesthetic. But at the same time, she also gets loads of taxpayer money. So on the one hand, she's supposed to be the head of state, the sovereign, but literally plays zero to very little in terms of the actual politics. So again, why should I care? I'm not one of these people that would be like, oh, I'm a progressive and I hate monarchy because I think, oh, you know, how unequal, how unegalitarian it is to have a monarch. I'm perfectly open to having, you know, a royal autocracy of Great Britain, as long as it actually serves a political function and provides order for the British people. But we're not getting that. So, you know, I don't want this royal family. If we replace the royal family with, I guess, ideologues that wanted to actually rule Britain in the interests of its people and in the, you know, maintaining healthy order for the British state, then that would be great. But we don't get that. So why should I care?
Yeah, and you mentioned the progressives there as well. And of course, they protested the royal family's very racist, even though there's absolutely no evidence for this at all. I mean, all their policies are very anti-white, anti-Western. We've had Harry, Mary, and Meghan Markle. Was that a gesture because Harry's not important? Or do you think that the Queen, on some level, does want to protect their bloodline and is a bit of a throwaway, is a bit of a token in a multicultural society? Or are they genuinely... I mean, for people to call them racist, considering some of the things they say, they are very liberal. And, you know, what's his name, William, you know, he's into all sorts of multicultural and progressive ideas. But do you think that there is anything in the royal family that actually still does want to maintain their bloodline? And that was a kind of an aberration with throwing the multicultural progressives something to remain relevant, or euro?
Well, I'm not sure specifically if they were in favour of keeping a bloodline. You'd think they'd be in general in favour of keeping the blood of the nation, as opposed to what they are doing, just going along with this sick multicultural society. on the one hand, obviously the Queen has an immense amount of power, and the royals generally. Ironically, if she ever came out and said, you know, like, I'm putting an end to all this multiculturalism and anti-white discrimination, the very same middle-class people who go out and wave the flags would probably be the ones most against her, saying, oh, how dare you, you know, offend these modern shibboleths. But, you know, if the Queen is directly in control of the army, not Parliament, and if she said, you know, that's it, we're putting things back to how they should be, I'm sure she'd have a lot of support, because there's people in there who, you know, they may not know much either way, but their instincts are in the right place.
Yeah. Well, talking about armies, I don't think I've spoken to you about it, Euro, in the last podcast. We did discuss Russia, Ukraine. I haven't had your input on the Russia, whole Russia, Ukraine, Wesley. But I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that whole thing.
I don't have a particularly strong feeling about it. Geopolitics has never been my area of interest. But whenever I do talk about it, I do often stress that when you think about Russia, I think that it's got a more optimistic future than any Western state. And because it's an autocracy, it's not a liberal democracy, therefore, in theory, the autocrat should be above and be more powerful than the merchant class.
We've lost Wesley again.
You've lost me? Can you hear me?
No, go ahead. You're back now. Yeah, I don't know whether that's my end or your end. But...
I think
that might be your end, Paul. I could hear him just fine.
Okay.
So in the West, we're ruled by the money class, whereas in Russia, Putin is the head honcho. So if he wants to crack down on things like the LGBT propaganda, he has the power to do so. Whereas in the West, all the politicians just do as they're told, as they're lobbied to do so. Obviously, we're a liberal democracy, so we subscribe to liberal values. And I think, a sexual libertinism fits into that nicely. The promotion of sexual deviancy and sexual diversity neatly fits in with the egalitarianism and the individualism. We also have secular values like separation of church and state. In Russia, the Orthodox state is the Orthodox faith is promoted and endorsed by the state, whereas it's not here. So when I think, oh, what would be better for people living in Ukraine? Which regime?
Yeah, I don't know what's happening there, lads. What did I miss? Yeah, I was going to say if it happens again, just crack on.
To sum up my point, I was saying that in the long term, I think the Ukrainian peoples would be much better served under Russian occupation, quite frankly, than the existing Ukraine political order, because the current Ukrainian political order will just become westernized. It will become liberalized. It will be drawn into NATO and all of the, you know, the liberal consensus of the West, which, you know, is just going to lead to the ruination of more European people's history and well-being. Whereas Russia, it's definitely not a perfect country. You know, its inheritance is communism. It's quite poor. So many people just live, like, their day-to-day living is pretty miserable. It's one of the most miserable countries in the world. I think they've got the highest rate of abortion out of all of Europe. The kinds of places these people live are horrible, urban, brutalist environments. But in the long term, if we're talking about over the next century, I think Russians and anybody under the Russian occupation is going to be a lot better off, because they've still got their faith. They're not all degenerate atheists. They're still ethnically homogenous for now. Whether that will change will have to be seen. And I just generally think that, you know, it's better to have the kind of autocracy that they've got, where hopefully the perversions that the merchant international class want to push on the people to weaken them and exploit them will have less power over there. So, you know, my general view is that it's better for Ukrainians to be, you know, under Russian occupation, as perverse as that might sound.
I'd have two problems with what you've just said in terms of the terminology as well. Is one, the use of westernized. you know, to mean degenerated and going down the path of the same problems that we have now. I think all the issues that we're having are not inherently Western and are actually against a lot of classical Western thought. So I disagree with that term of like, oh, it's become Westernized, meaning gay and anti-white. You know, obviously not. But also, you said Ukraine under occupation. These people are near enough are Russians. They're a region. They speak a dialect of Russian. It would be like Northumbria being made its own country and saying, oh, you know, the Northumbrians are going to be occupied by the Mercians. Isn't it evil? But the Kievan Rus in Ukraine was actually the foundation of the original Russian state. And these people are ethnic kin. They're much closer ethnically to the Russians than they are to their own leader. The Jewish president who took over in a coup, Western government-backed coup a few years ago.
Yeah, well, I'm definitely no expert in Ukrainian-Russian history. I am aware that obviously their histories are very much intertwined, but there are a lot of people who live in Ukraine that obviously want Ukrainian nationalism, that, you know, they want a Ukrainian state, they identify as Ukrainian. So those people might obviously be disheartened that, you know, formerly Russia will be in control of their politics, but I think
in large part the animosity that exists from Ukrainians against Russians is based on what the Soviet Union did when it was ruled not by Russians but by Zelensky's people.
Exactly.
And now that Zelensky is running the country, he's using the hatred of what his people did to Ukraine as a reason for them to attack their own kith and kin.
Wow, it's
so disgusting.
It's so inverted, and yeah, you're so right. Zelensky obviously is not an ethnic Ukrainian, and so in theory, a lot of these people that say they want Ukrainian independence and to be separate from Russia, what they're asking for is to have their current regime where they're not even ruled by their own kind. So it's very much twisted, isn't it?
Well, it's like to some extent, it's like the Ukrainians are drinking the Western Kool-Aid, and they seem to think, you know, that they're better off coming into NATO and the EU. And as you say, there's probably some negativity around communist Russia, which is not communist anymore. But you've got a divide there in the Ukraine, which is what caused a lot of the problems, where you have the west of Ukraine and Kiev, obviously, they speak Ukrainian. And then over in the Donbass region, the Donetsk and the Luhansk region, they speak Russian. And the Crimea is the same. They speak Russian. They're members of the Orthodox Church, the Russian Orthodox Church, that is. And they largely see themselves as Russians. It's a bit like the Northern Ireland situation, actually, where you have that little group of loyalists in Northern Ireland who feel threatened by the larger Irish nationalist population and want to remain loyal to Britain. And what happened was, when the coup occurred, those two regions didn't recognize the new government in Kiev, and Poroshenko came in and was just a maniac and started bombing them and sending in those so-called neo-Nazi groups that went in there and started going house to house raiding, looking for so-called terrorists in the Donbass region, and they killed, I think they killed 14,000 of them in an 8-year period. So that's when all the trouble started, after the coup, which was obviously orchestrated by the State Department in Washington. And yet we're told in our media that and you hear this from liberals. I was in my uncle's the other day, and he was churning out the usual BBC tropes before he finally told me we had to change the conversation. He actually raised his voice, and he's usually a pretty peaceful kind of a guy, but they just couldn't handle any other challenges to their worldview on this. And I said to him, it's not a simple situation there. And, trying to talk to them about the Donbass region and what happened there, and, the whole idea that Putin is just pure evil, we've heard it all before. And, you know, I think a lot of the Ukrainians actually buy into this stuff as well. And it's very frustrating because, you know, geopolitics, it needs to have a reality aspect to it. There's no point us saying, you know, they'll say one of the you know, arguments that they make is that, well, Ukraine has the right to determine its own future and be independent. But if you know anything, you know it's not independent. You know, when you have Victoria Nuland actually choosing and deciding who the next leader is going to be, I mean, this is not my version of democracy. And this is one of the reasons that Putin is in there, because he doesn't want a hostile puppet in there. He actually wants genuine independence for Ukraine or a puppet of his own. Go ahead, Euro.
Yeah, so sorry, I've stumbled over my words there a bit. There's this kind of schizophrenic idea amongst the Western governments, the anti-whites, who promote of, you know, self-determination. We're all in favour of self-determination and people ruling themselves, unless it goes with whatever their agenda is, and then they're against self-determination, and then you're an evil Nazi. You know, there's no right for the British, English, Welsh, Irish, Scottish people to have self-determination, to rule ourselves, to do things that are in our interests. But as soon as there's some little group that they can use as a wedge against others, and they've done this with like the Kurds in the Middle East for ages. They use the Kurds as a wedge against other groups like the Turks and the Syrians and whatnot.
And the moderate rebels in Syria, yeah.
Yeah, the modern so-called rebels in Syria. And they don't give a toss about these people. They use the supposed, you know, supposed sanctified self-determination as an excuse to just go in and actually oppress people who do have self-determination. They use the talk of self-determination to destroy self-determination in the same way they use the talk of democracy. And whenever there's populism, meaning people actually getting what they want from the government, whenever there's populism, people voting for what they want is anti-democratic and has to be shut down. The democracy is anti-democratic, and self-determination is against the self-determination of all peoples.
Yeah, and of course, when we're talking about the West, you know, it is worth clarifying. It's the Jewish infected West.
The contemporary West, yeah. not all of the legacy of its philosophy, of course, but the contemporary West for sure.
Yeah, and one of the telltale signs, of course, which shows that you're dealing with Jews, is because they will support whatever suits their interests. If they need to be pro-Nazi for a couple of months, they will be. If they need to be anti-communist because they might see China as a threat, then all of a sudden you're already seeing it. You're going to start to see this anti-communist China propaganda, particularly coming out of like centrist right types and pro-Zionist types. So they just switch around. Whatever suits them, that works for them. You know, they can be far left, they can be Bolsheviks. The irony is, the Ukrainians are going straight out of the fire and into the frying pan if they want to join the West. You know, the Bolsheviks who destroyed Russia are now destroying the West. It's pretty much the same people.
It's interesting that you compared the Ukraine situation to the Northern Ireland situation as well. I mean, looking at that more generally, and I know that we've probably talked about this in the past, regardless of what you think, who was right, who was wrong in terms of the fight that went on there, you can see it's all pointless now. You know, the Irish supposedly fought for self-determination against the English British government, and now their own country is accelerating at an even greater rate towards this demographic annihilation, towards the extinction of the Irish people. Like, what was that whole conflict for? And, you know, if Ukraine does come out of this aligned with the West in any way, you know, if there's a whatever rump state might survive and become part of the Western sphere, effectively, is going to be ethnically cleansed in exactly the same way that all the other white countries are being.
Yeah. And an interesting twist on this, if you like, and this might be by design, it might not be, but the reality is not only are the sanctions hurting us more, but by taking Russia off the SWIFT system, they are making it very difficult for them to basically send wheat to Africa. And in places like Mali and other places in Africa where their populations are exploding, this is going to exacerbate hunger problems in Africa, because Africans, you know, the reality is they need a lot of external development and, you know, things like that to help them produce food and things like that. So if you have these rising populations in Africa and those rising exploding populations are also hungry, they're going to be on the move, and they're not going to China and they're not going to Israel. And I wonder, is any of that by design? Are they attempting to also starve the Africans so that we have an absolute African black tsunami heading our way?
It's an interesting point for sure. Honestly, it doesn't matter what happens. The elites always manage to manipulate it so that we get more immigrants. Honestly,
yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. It's so worrying though, because I mean, in Mali, it's 5.85. That's the average birth rate for your average, you know, woman in Mali, and then just imagine that they're on the move because they're hungry. I mean, it doesn't even bear thinking about, but it just kind of came up when we were thinking, because this is having an effect on you know, on African populations, you know.
Well, there's so many African people that whether they were starving or not, I think there's still a sizable millions and millions of them that would want to move to the West anyway, because we have rule of law, we have you know, very big wealthy economy, and the welfare state
in this country.
Not for white people, obviously, but we have property rights, we have a thriving economy, you know, so it's like, oh yeah, let's go there, because there's a lot of genocides that go on in Africa. Obviously people are very poor, so oh, let's go to the liberal democratic West and you know, exploit their orderly societies, which are orderly for now, but obviously they're creaking and decaying. But again,
A question for both of you. I was talking to a guy who listens to my show when I do a show with David Duke, and we were talking about, you know, the demographics, and I've been having one of those periods where it's just I feel as if I need to get out of London. It seems to have just gotten worse. And actually, since we left the EU, non-EU immigration has gone through the roof. And it just, I went to Richmond Park yesterday, and I think I saw about half a dozen, you know, white people. Just the place was just flooded with Arabs, blacks, even quite a few Indonesians and Chinese and things like that. I don't know whether on holiday or what.
Hong Kongers.
And a lot of Eastern Europeans. And no one even bothers speaking the language here. I mean, you just, you know, they're all just talking in their own language or in their own little groups. And so I was talking to a guy earlier who listens to my show with David Duke. I had a chat with him, you know, just me and him off air. Is it too late? I mean, do we avoid this in our own minds? I know it's a hard question, but we all think about it. Is it irreversible now? What do you think?
I don't think it is irreversible. I think it's going to be hard, and it certainly gets harder every day. But we knew that this wasn't going to be a quick struggle. This is going to be a long struggle. It's going to be probably multi-generational. And what we do now is going to you know, is going to change things with regards to how easy that's going to be for our descendants to win. But our enemy would like us to believe it's impossible, to believe that it's already hopeless, because then we won't even try. And actually, demoralization is one of their biggest tactics, because there are lots of people in our country and in white countries around the world who understand what's going on to some degree. And especially amongst the boomers, you get this sort of mentality of helplessness. You know, it's like, oh, well, I know, you know, but I'll be dead by then anyway. That comes from not seeing a path forwards. And we need to show people that there is a way. And actually, if we show them that there is a way, it won't matter if we're 20% of the country. You know, if we are a united 20% of the country, we would be able to, you know, run things and take back control over a period of time. But we are not at that stage yet. What is more important than our numbers is our cohesion and the degree to which our people are united in our struggle.
Yeah, I mean, I will say this. Those of us who are aware of it and who recognize the problem, as small as we might be, I think, you know, there are more people who think like us, but who are probably intimidated or whatever. But those of us who are thinking the way we do and we recognize what's going on, it is a pretty strong core, I'll say that. It's the same with the guys in America. They're very, you know, they have a lot of conviction about it. I mean, you guys have, I have, Mark Collett has, everyone who goes to PA has. So even though we recognize this, you know, this obvious threat demographically and to our culture generally, it's a strong core. It's a good starting point, I guess, is my point, you know?
Yeah, well, the thing to be optimistic about is, like, we are a group of people. We have a vision, and we just need to come together and actually organize and create institutions. I don't think we'll take back the old ones, unfortunately. They've been corrupted and, you know, infiltrated by the left, but we can make our own institutions and build a vanguard and hopefully, you know, wrestle control back. And when I think about, oh, is it doomed for the future? Well, one of the best things about the pro-diversity agenda is that it allows all of the immigrants to retain their native cultures. For example, you were saying, oh, they don't speak to each other. They don't even learn English. Well, that's actually a good thing. That's a good thing because then it means they're going to be associating amongst separate. Themselves more. Yeah, they're going to be separate. So we may occupy the same space, physical space, but so long as they are encouraged to have their differences, their own cultures, what have you, that strengthens us, that you know, maintains, you know, the separateness. And unless there's a movement from the left in the future to, you know, force integration and to force a monoculture, to create like a new multiracial monoculture, you know, we should be optimistic that the immigrants coming in basically have free rein, because it means they're going to more keep to themselves and be distinct from the natives.
Yeah, integration is genocide, and ultimately the more separateness there is and the more these people stay in their own communities, the easier it will be to disentangle them from our country in the future.
I think the weak link in this is our women, because for example, you have the exaltation and the glamorization of black culture. You see a hell of a lot of black girls or white girls with black guys. There's a lot of mixed race kids around who don't really have any real identity to one side or the other. And I guess that is their goal. It depends, I suppose, how much of that continues and where the balance is with that in terms of, you know, to the point where it is such a difficult knot to untangle, because I agree.
There's a lot of negrophilia in the West, absolutely, like, you know, glamorization of black culture. And you get so many white people that, you know, fall victim to this. They buy into rap and hip hop culture. They buy into the mannerisms and how black people speak. And it's really depressing. They don't tend to do it as much. They don't do it as much with other groups. Like, they're not trying to turn white people into behaving like Muslims or Arabs. It is always black culture that's forced on whites. And unfortunately, far too many whites adopt it.
If whites behaved more like Muslims, you know, we'd actually be forming strong communities fighting back against this.
Yeah.
You know, Paul, you did mention, you know, it's going to be a difficult knot to untie. But we learned from Alexander that you just have to cut the Gordian knot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not without hope. I think you go through periods where you're more red pilled or you're more black pilled than other times. But maybe, you know, it's also where I live. I went to Tesco earlier. Again, and it felt like more like a refugee center than England. I came out of there just to add insult to injury. I saw a really pretty white girl with a black guy. He looked like, honestly, this guy was real black. It's honestly a bit overwhelming sometimes. It just ruins your day. And one of the other things that I've been talking about, and this is an irony and a kind of a, you know, hypocrisy of so-called progressives who think they're so educated and worldly. This does not happen around the world. I mean, okay, you've got South America where it's pretty mixed up there, but if you were an alien coming down to Earth, you would look around the world and Europe would be an aberration, because you would see all these people who have their own little patches, and then they're all in Europe too, and there's these white people. They must be really kind. They share their land with all these other people. They may even have sympathy, but yet the irony is we're called racist, you know, and intolerant. And, you know, there's a complete brick wall if you were, like, when you're trying to talk to progressives about this, but they are so provincial in their thinking. You know, when they call you racist, it's, well, compared to who?
Yeah, it's always worth doing that to try and win over a normie, is pointing out those contradictions. But unfortunately, you know, a lot of the contradictions do work. It doesn't matter how people still are guilt tripped not to think in those ways, because there's too many consequences if they start to think in the manner that we do.
Or they're just not capable of it. I mean, they are, you know, they're so susceptible to the propaganda.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, and it is very, very aggressive, you know, propaganda, and, you know, it's a complete menticide operation, you know.
Something you guys said about, you know, Wesley, you mentioned building our own institutions and also, you know, maybe behaving more like the Muslims in some ways, not others. You know, I think something that's going to be really beneficial for us in future is building organizations like there's a Muslim Council of Britain. You know, we need a white Council of Britain, or just British Council of Britain, but one that is ethnically homogenous, you know, not just a civic nationalist organization, but things like this that will put out statements and say, you know, we're for this or we're against this, or we represent this group of people and their interests. And just because it will create a certain degree of cognitive dissonance amongst our enemies and amongst these anti-whites, you know, because it's one of those things where they'll see it and they'll say, well, that's racist. And it's like, okay, well, is the Muslim Council of Britain racist? No. Well, that's just a religion, you know, it's not racist. Okay, well, what about like this black African caucus?
The word Jewish Council.
Yes, exactly.
The German Jewish Council and the French Jewish Council and the every other little Jewish group, including, you know, they have their groups everywhere. Again, I mean, it's a huge double standard. But, you know, there are us, you know, there's guys like us. But, you know, I think white people, they do tend, I know there's like a brainwashing operation going on, you know, and we're under attack. But white people, they do lack a certain togetherness, you know. I mean, it's everything to the Jew that his neighbor is a Jew. But to the white man, it doesn't mean that much, you know. Maybe it does more than I think. But
we're genetically disadvantaged for sure. Like, there is evidence to suggest that European people are just more individualist inclined and less racially centric. But we were racially centric before, so we can literally see into history, like, no, we can have a racial consciousness and be loyal to each other. We're at a slight disadvantage, but we just have to reignite the flame. And yeah, and again, look, it doesn't matter what race you are. Human beings, the masses are so susceptible to propaganda. So if you control the means of propaganda, you can control whether the white race is unified or not. So again, you just got to wrestle back the means of propaganda, really. So I think we can be racially united again.
It's hard to kind of look at Western countries and at white people now and say, oh, we're just inherently predisposed to be this way, because it's like doing a scientific study without a control group. You know, you can't just say, oh, we're predisposed to be this way, because there's no group of white people anywhere in the world that's not been exposed to this anti-white propaganda. And I'm sure that we're not quite as ethnocentric as, you know, Jewish people or say the Han Chinese, you know, but we were ethnocentric enough. And, you know, not just racially as a continent, but Europeans were fighting against each other for centuries. You know, it was the English race versus the French race, not just the white race. And you know, whether or not we say that's a good thing, it certainly allowed us to hone our skills in battle and to come up with new technologies and whatnot. But in the absence of this propaganda, certainly we will return to a more natural state, and we could even have a change where we're, instead of degrading this, we could be reinforcing it. You know, if it's something that's not strong enough naturally, then we could reinforce our ethnocentric tendencies.
Yeah. I did a podcast last night on RBN with a couple of guys, including Dennis Wise. Are you familiar with Dennis Wise?
Yep.
I'm not.
Well, Dennis Wise produced the documentary, The Greatest Story Never Told. Have you seen it?
I've seen a significant proportion of it, yeah.
Right. I've at least started watching it.
It's the really long one, isn't it? That one, I think.
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that kept coming up was the spiritual aspect of it. Where are you guys at spiritually? Oof, about, you know, gosh. what we're dealing with.
I mean, I am a hard atheist. I can't choose to believe. I used to be quite anti-religious in general. And now I'm only anti-religious against two main religions. And, you know, I'm happily call myself a cultural Christian. But I don't believe in a sort of spiritual battle going on. The one thing that really does predispose me towards believing in any sort of spiritual battle is just the unbridled evil of our enemies. You know, like, you see some of the stuff they do can only be described as satanic, you know. And if there's a Satan, then there must be a God as well.
That is kind of how I came to Christ, because I started seeing these guys like worshiping Moloch and sort of benefiting from the kind of worldly offerings that Satan offered Jesus in when he was in the wilderness. And I came to that conclusion. I thought, why are these guys worshiping this like Moloch figure in the Old Testament? And they're all like world leaders. They're all very wealthy. They're all very powerful. And then I came to that same conclusion. I thought, well, maybe it seems that this Satan guy is real. So maybe the good guy in the Bible is real too. Where are you at with the spiritual stuff, Wesley? Because it did come up. I mean, I'm pretty sure from talking to them last night. I mean, I know a couple of guys are definitely Christians, and Dennis Wise, you know, they were talking a lot about Freemasons and the occult and everything else. So where are you at with this?
Well, I've never really liked the good versus evil narrative, just because I feel like it comes across as quite juvenile at times. However, just like Euro, when I look at our enemies, you know, I do think, no, absolutely, they are evil. And I think the reason why I don't really like the good versus evil dichotomy is because, I mean, our inherent position is that man is flawed. But when I look across the opposition, our enemies, I'm like, no, they are totally depraved, unscrupulous. They just promote evil. So in that sense, yeah, I do see it as a war between good and evil. I've never been particularly anti-religious. I've never just really had that instinct to mock religion. Like, I'm not particularly theistic myself, yet if I do see, for example, comedians or whatever, you know, taking the mick out of Christianity, usually I just find the jokes kind of pathetic, and I really appreciate the logic and the need for religion. And I've felt religious at times. Like last year, for example, I felt particularly drawn to being spiritual, but you know, it kind of goes up and down. But I don't subscribe to any formal faith myself. But yeah, no, I see evil around. I know what's evil. I know there's wrongdoing. And yeah, I don't have a particular aversion to God either. So,
regardless of the sort of metaphysical truth of religion, I kind of view religion as a social technology, yeah, something that was required civilizationally for our people to develop to a certain level. And we can look at, you know, before there was really a united Europe racially, there was a Europe united under Christendom, which helped to bring our people together along those racial lines. But yeah, regardless of the metaphysical truth of religion, it's a social technology. And it's something that I think it's possible to get rid of it, but only if you replace it with something else. And in our own societies, you know, it's been removed, but nothing has replaced it. You need some sort of worldview or
egalitarianism
as the place.
Well, listen, I'd have to stop you there because it has been replaced. It's been replaced by Judaism. And they deliberately replaced it. It's been replaced by Jewish revolutionary ideas, and they deliberately secularized the United States and the West so they could fill the void with their, you know, Judaism.
Yes, now we have the religion of multiculturalism and white extinction.
But how do they justify it? They justify it with appeals to egalitarianism, individualism, and harm avoidance. You know, those are kind of the pillars in which people subscribe to the dogma and the ideology that we're given, isn't it? So that's kind of like the new religion.
White supremacy and the enslavement of blacks is like the original sin of our new religion.
Yeah. But, you know, also, I mean, when you look at the history of Jews in Europe, you're looking at a history between Christian Europe and Jews. And the reason that the Jews got into so much trouble was eventually, for the most part, they came up against the Christian leaders, notwithstanding the Dark Ages, which is for the most part an abomination of a representation of Christianity.
I thought the reason they got into so much trouble is because they kept abducting, you know, Christian children and draining their blood.
Well, but this is what I'm saying, but this is in the Talmud. So when the Christians got wind of the Talmud, for example, when the recent Notre Dame Cathedral was burnt down, the Notre Dame Cathedral has very historical relevance between, you know, the enmity between the Catholic Church and, you know, which was the dominant Christian, you know, institution, and Jews. I mean, and there's statues in front of it, which has the ecclesia, which represents Christianity and Christ, and the synagogue being at war. Personally, I don't think that was an accident that the cathedral was burnt down. There's also been Jews that have come out and said that it's a good thing. It's actually a sovereign work of God because of anti-Semitism. But the Talmud, there was a council after... I think it was the 11th century in Paris. There was a council that basically routed out the Jews and the Talmud and burnt the Talmud. So that has been the history between Jews and Christianity. And when I was talking to Andrew Joyce, I was like, what is really driving these people, Andrew? This was maybe like 5 years ago. And he said it was revenge for their view of anti-Semitism in history, you know?
Yeah, well, I mean, I find it hard to kind of look at the Catholic Church, especially throughout history, and where the Catholic Church is now, and support being a Catholic. I mean, I know there's a certain segment of people on the right who say, well, you know, like there is this kind of metaphysical good and evil, and this battle going on where our enemies are just inherently evil, and you know, we need to fight against this by becoming good Catholics, and then they join the Catholic Church, which supports most of the same things that these evil anti-whites, anti-Christians do in the first place. You know, and there's a certain degree of those people who will say, well, I'm a Sata Vacantist, which just means empty chairism. Well, you know, the Pope's not the Pope, because the Pope wouldn't be empty Christian, and he is, therefore he can't be. And it's just a bit childish, really, like that we don't have any proper religious institutions that are in favor of us. And, you know, the ones that do exist are kind of fundamentally anti-Christian. And we need to build, you know, if we are going to go down the Christian route, we need to build a new church, new organizations that are going to actually follow what's in those books.
Yeah, I mean, since the Second Vatican Council, I mean, you know, the Catholic Church is a joke. I mean, I'm not a Catholic myself. I mean, I was brought up in an Irish kind of, yeah, it wasn't shoved down my throat. I mean, I enjoyed going to the Mass and everything else, but theologically, I mean, I think a lot of the Catholic theology is nonsense, basically, and it's not. I don't see any basis for it, but the fact remains that and including Luther, Martin Luther was incredibly outspoken about the Jews and their influence in the Talmud and everything else. But the point I was trying to make is basically that when you look at European history, it's inextricably linked with, you know, the Christianity that we had, which was the Catholic Church for the most part until the Reformation came along. And of course, the Reformation came along and that caused other problems, which were pro-Jew, including, you know, the phenomenon of Christian Zionism. But anyway, we got into a lot of these sorts of things last night. I was just interested in where you guys were at spiritually, you know.
I mean, I'd kind of like to be religious or to have that kind of not that I don't believe in what we believe in, but I think there's an immense amount of moral conviction that you get from saying, you know, like, I am just 100% right. God is behind me with this Deus Vult. Let's go. And I've seen that in other people. And you know, it's something that's very good, you know, for us and for our cause. But I just can't choose to believe, you know. And as I say, I used to be quite anti-religious. Now I'm only really against Islam and Judaism, and I'd call myself a cultural Christian. But I mean, I can't look at even what's in the books and say, well, that's right or whatnot. And, you know, I kind of do feel like there is something lacking that needs to be replaced, as I say, whether it be with some sort of other ideology or worldview, it's possible. But, you know, it's an interesting thing to think about.
Yeah.
I've never particularly felt the need to bash, say, Christianity, because there's nothing in Christianity which inherently I object to. Nothing at all. In fact, most of my own morality is completely in alignment with Christian values. Again, the thing is, with when it comes to topics about faith, there's a spectrum, isn't there? Some people are just by their nature extremely prone to having deep, deep spiritual faith, and then other people not as much. But yeah, I've just never felt the need to, you know, just rail against, say, Christianity, because I ultimately don't object to anything about it. Usually most people's, when they're going on, say, anti-religious rants, they're usually just moaning about, oh, how ridiculous it is that somebody would put their faith in something they can't see, or, an you know, an almighty being and stuff like this. But in terms of the lifestyle and the moral framework which something like Christianity provides, like, I just can't object to it. So again, the idea of mocking it just seems a bit silly to me.
Well, the irony is, from my point of view, that I have more problems with Christians than I do with non-Christians, because, you know, because non-Christians don't claim to be Christians. But, you know, when I mean, particularly sadly with pastors who indulge in worldviews and attitudes which are so far removed from Christianity and so infected by, you know, cultural Marxist, essentially Judaistic ideas, these are the guys I end up clashing with, you know. And it's very frustrating for me, and to the point that, you know, because I am a Christian and I've read and studied the Bible, I didn't become a Christian because I went to a church. It happened organically. It happened in a spiritual way over a period of time. I go into these churches, and I mean, it is painful. It really is. No, honestly, it is. You realize that it's like, it's almost pointless to go to a church, you know?
We need to just draw a line in the sand and just say there is no hope for any formal, you know, permitted, organized, say, Christian institutions. We have to build our own. If you have faith in God and you're on the distant right, you know, literally make your own. All of the institutions have been corrupted by now. And also our enemies would want to suppress any legitimate Christian organizations. So if you're going to have the kind of ones you want to go to, we're going to have to form our own.
Well, it's like the old joke about white Sharia, but that's basically just Mormonism. You know, they used to not allow blacks into their congregations, but they've kind of been corrupted that as well, you know.
All right, lads, listen, you know, it's I think we're going to have to wrap it up, because we had that little break, which I've got to include because this is a pre-recorded show. Any final comments?
No, not especially, but I'm glad to come on the show again, and I'll be happy to come back on in the future. It's been very enjoyable.
Well, you've been more than welcome.
It's been a good talk. Thanks for having me on, Paul. It's been good talking to you again, Euro. And if you want to find my work, last time I was on Paul's show, I was doing the Farius podcast. I've now switched it back to doing Renew Britannia, and you can find that on Odyssey. And you can also find my Telegram and Twitter accounts as well. So make sure to check those out.
Okay, great. I will be back again next Sunday. I will be live with Richard Carried tomorrow at 12 central, so tune in for that. Okay, thank you and take care.
Been building our online store. While we have been focusing on bringing you the best talk show host in the country, here at Republic Broadcasting Network, we also want our listeners to have products they can use every day and in times of emergency. We have added new products each week to our store. Your support of this network, plus products at the best prices, is a win-win situation. Check out our new store. Go to our website, republicbroadcasting.org, and click on the online store located at the top of our website. Together, we can continue to grow RBN and help our listeners prepare for the future. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and click on our online store, or call us.
800-724-2719, extension 3. 800-724-2719, extension 3.
You're listening to Real Talk Radio, only on the Republic Broadcasting Network.